And I'm just opening some questions. And, well, in the first one, actually, just for the record, if you could please say my name is with your full name and title.
Sure. Richard Isaacson, MD. I'm the director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic and Center for Brain Health at Florida Atlantic University Schmidt College of Medicine.
And I wanted to ask you a bit about how, well, like Giselle and I were talking on before about how a lot of times people come to get care for Alzheimer's disease once it's too late, you know, like there's really not much prevention or just not at least some. If you could tell us about what approach you take with patients or what would you recommend people do, and how would anyone know, for instance, that maybe they're susceptible to developing it?
Sure. So most people are unaware that Alzheimer's disease begins in the brain decades before the first symptom of memory loss. And that leaves a lot of time to make brain healthy choices, to understand what risk factors the person may have to put a person on the road to Alzheimer's, and a lot of time to intervene. You know, we don't have a perfect magic pill or magic bullet or magic potion or anything like that to prevent or cure Alzheimer's. But we do know now, based on the 2020 Lancet Commission, which is a major, you know, report and a major scientific journal, that 4 out of every 10 cases of Alzheimer's and dementia may be preventable if that person does everything right. The problem there is, you know, there's some, you know, cause for hope, but there's also cause for, well, what about the other 60%? Maybe we can delay by a few months, a year or two or 5 years. And hey, that's great. Maybe in that time, that blockbuster drug comes and we can, you know, lengthen the time, you know, and then truly prevent Alzheimer's. But, you know, not all people are on the same road to Alzheimer's disease. And the future of Alzheimer's is figuring out which road a person's on and then intervening in a very specific targeted way for that person.
And what would be something that if someone comes to you and maybe they have family history or they're starting to maybe sense that there's some change in their cognition, like what would be something you might recommend?
Well, you know, I hate to say it, but once a person is already starting to exhibit some degree of symptoms, I don't want to say it's too late. I don't want to say that, but I just want to say that it's the interventions towards protecting brain health over time and the ability for medical care to impact the curve and bend the curve on the progression of cognitive decline. You know, we got to start earlier before symptoms begin. 46 million Americans currently have Alzheimer's disease beginning in their brain silently. This is a stage called stage 1, preclinical or pre-symptomatic Alzheimer's, and those people have no symptoms at all. And the only way we can detect this is through, you know, coming to a clinic setting and doing some research-based procedures as well as some clinical procedures, some cognitive assessments. So if I had to say one thing, it's better to come early. The problem is there's just not that many places to go. You know, we have a consortium of program, you know, 6, 7, 8 clinics throughout the country and the world currently that we work with. We've had over 40 to 50 visitors to our original clinic that was started back in 2013. But I guess what I'm trying to say is we got to start earlier. If someone really wants to have an impact before having symptoms, better. Now, that being said, if someone has symptoms, you know, don't be ashamed. Break the stigma. Take a deep breath. There are things that are not Alzheimer's disease that can cause cognitive changes. There's a lot of things that can cause cognitive changes that may be reversible or treatable. And even if someone has the earliest phases of Alzheimer's, that's okay. There's things that we can do now. This is a different disease than it was. You know, when my Uncle Bob was diagnosed back in 1995, we didn't have anything. We didn't have treatments. We saw a doctor, and the doctor said, "I'm sorry, you have dementia, it's Alzheimer's, and there's nothing we can do." At least now there's several FDA-approved drugs for symptomatic therapy, even newer drugs for earlier stages, and none of these drugs are perfect. I don't want to, you know, get anyone's hopes up too much, but, I mean, these are drugs that I use on a routine basis, and I think there are things that can be done from a pharmacological, from a non-drug approach, diet, lifestyle, exercise, monitoring cardiovascular disease risk factors. But when someone comes in with cognitive changes, they need to have an assessment. They need to have a detailed medical history. They need to understand, could this be depression? Something called a pseudo-dementia of depression. People with you know, problems with depression have trouble with paying attention to things. If someone can't pay attention to things, they're not going to remember things. So you want to kind of understand what common things happen commonly. Make sure it's not a thyroid condition, a B vitamin deficiency, things like that. And then do cognitive assessments, and then do brain imaging. You know, for example, doing an MRI of the brain can understand if there's shrinkage in different parts of the brain that are, you know, related to Alzheimer's pathology or the disease. So I think it's really essential that if someone has any degree of cognitive changes, what in any way, shape, or form, even if they're minor, to not delay. Talk to your doctor. Now, again, here we go again. That being said, a lot of doctors say, oh, you're probably fine. It's just normal aging. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Go home. See you in a year. Well, that's not the best idea either. I think some people out there just really need to be their own advocate. You know, we, for example, launched a brain health course at FAU. If you go to faumedicine.org/ALZ, which is our website, we actually just launched a free course on brain health and Alzheimer's prevention. We also talk about some rudimentary things we can do for vascular cognitive decline prevention, Lewy body prevention, Parkinson's prevention. This is an area that we definitely want to explore over the coming years and grow. But, you know, knowledge is power. If someone, you know, is seen by their doctor and, you know, there's not much recommended, okay, go home, exercise, eat a healthy diet, get your blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugar under control. That's a good start. It's a great start, actually. But, you know, take control of your own brain health. Grab the bull by the horns. Get educated. There's free stuff out there. We give it out for free. And there's other stuff out there too. So, yeah. And when in doubt, see a neurologist. It's hard to get neurology appointments. You know, it's hard. Doctors are overwhelmed. I have empathy for patients, empathy for physicians. It's been a tough time in medicine for everybody. With staffing shortages and everything else and resource limitations. But just get evaluated. Take a deep breath. Bring an advocate with you. Bring a patient. Bring a caregiver, a family member, and get evaluated. Don't fear. Fear is paralyzing. We need to do something about it and get evaluated.
You had mentioned stigma, and I wonder, like, one thing that made this interview, I think, a really great idea is to kind of have more discussions on Alzheimer's. And I'm wondering if you find that patients, they don't really make plans for Alzheimer's care. And, like, let's say you don't have children and you can't just depend on someone that they're going to take care of you. Should we also be having those like, I don't know how many options there are around for someone who may develop Alzheimer's, but I guess you any thoughts on kind of thinking about maybe if you have family history, if there's some planning that can be done rather than leaving it for the end?
Yeah, well, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? And prevention is not just about brain health, and prevention is not just about, you know, minimizing risk factors for heart disease and brain disease and strokes and stuff like that. But it's also preventing, you know, social and, you know, life issues that can get really complicated and really uncomfortable. And having a plan, you know, making one's wishes known about, you know, end-of-life care, for example, is something that's just completely avoided in most families. You know, what about being on a ventilator? What about having chest compressions? These are terribly uncomfortable conversations. I even as a physician, I've been through hundreds of these conversations, and they're terribly uncomfortable. But when it comes to Alzheimer's disease and planning and care, I mean, I think, you know, they're really essential. There's challenges when it comes to caregiving for Alzheimer's. There's no, you know, funding that is used. You know, most families, this most commonly, the eldest daughter is, you know, characteristically, stereotypically, but also statistically, most likely to have to be the one to care for a person with Alzheimer's disease. You know, making one's wishes known, and if the person before they have dementia, and they can still think and talk and care for themselves, but they may have the earliest phases, mild glitches of memory. Mild cognitive impairment is a term where someone has cognitive changes, but they can still take care of themselves. That's the phase when to have a family meeting and have a family talk and say, hey, listen, I know this is going to probably burden you guys at some point, but I'm sorry. Let's make a plan. I don't want your finances to be, you know, totally evaporated from care for me. Let's make a plan to try to make this better. whether you talk about long-term care insurance, whether you talk about putting money away so that you have a fund for you know, assisted living placement, nursing home placement. I don't have great answers here, but talking to a social worker at a memory disorder center, an Alzheimer's center, there's a variety of Alzheimer's foundations out there that can be relied on. And I think it's important to, when in doubt, call for help and get assistance. And unfortunately, the doctor's offices are not generally the best place for this because doctor's offices mainly deal with medical things, acute medical things, and, you know, other things. And I think having honest conversations about expectations of care, putting a family plan together is really critical. Again, I wish I had better answers, though.
Is there, and in terms of brain health, are there things, I think it might be also more typical of women to pursue in the retirement phase of life, like classes or things, and maybe, do you have advice for all people who maybe simple things that they can consider doing, that like really learning a language isn't just like some like really nice thing, something maybe that we really should do when we're 65 and older?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there are risk factors that increase the risk of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's and dementia. And then there are protective factors that can protect against Alzheimer's. And depending on where a person is at in the life course, there's early life factors, midlife factors, and late life factors. And I think in some ways it's good to think about it like that. You know, I don't know how long we have for this chat, but if we had 2 to 4 to 7 to 12 hours, I could give you all of them. But, you know, being that we don't have that kind of time, unfortunately, although we do have that online course, which is about 2.5 hours of free content, I'll do the best I can in a limited amount of time. Let's talk about the most important things, and that's exercise on a regular basis, healthy diet, modifying one's sleep, reducing one's stress, taking a deep breath, making a plan for one's brain health, making a plan for sleep, making a plan for exercise, a plan for meal selection, a plan for every aspect, a plan for cognitive activities. When it comes to cognitive activities, you know, there's that saying, if you don't use it, you lose it. Well, of course, staying cognitively engaged is critical. But if you don't love something, then maybe you shouldn't do it. Learning something new, a new language, a musical instrument, adult education classes, keeping the brain engaged, super important. You know, the list goes on and on. And then in each of these topics, there's a lot more granularity. I don't want people to think it's as easy as, okay, go exercise. Well, what do I mean by exercise? Well, there's a lot of differences. Just before this call, I had an hour-long meeting. I knew my day was going to get a little sideways, but I made a plan, and I got on my Peloton bike. Not trying to commercially promote Peloton. I'm on their health and wellness council, actually, so I'm not paid. Anyway, I was on my Peloton, and I was basically took a meeting, and I was sweating during the meeting, and the people were looking at me like, who's this guy? And I'm like, I'm sorry, I have no other time. I'm on baby duty today. Our babysitter's away, and I, you know, after nap time, I'm on. So I'm taking my 45 to 60 minutes on the Peloton at lower intensity, steady state cardio, where I can still talk. I'm going to have my heart rate at about 60 to 65% of its max. So for me personally, one way to do it, you take 220 minus your age and multiply that by 60%. And that's my target rate for low impact cardio. I then do higher intensity cardiovascular activity called high intensity interval training, where I go faster and slower and faster and slower. Do that at least once or twice a week, twice actually. And then I do strength training. Men and women really need to do this. As we age, we lose muscle, 1% of muscle per year. Women need a different plan. Men need a separate plan. Depending on one's body composition, you know, if someone wants to lose body fat, as the belly size gets larger, the memory center in the brain gets smaller, and a great way to lose body fat is steady state. We call it zone 2 training. I'm not going to get too in-depth about this right now. But mixing it up, doing higher intensity activity is really critical for certain people with certain genes that are at risk for Alzheimer's. And I do at least 2 to 3 times a week of steady state cardio for 45 to 60 minutes. Today I did it fasted. Fasting in the morning is a great way to kind of jumpstart both body fat loss as well as brain health in general. People weren't meant to eat around the clock. But you see, I can just keep going and going and going. The depth of exercise information is just, it's never ending. It's a rabbit hole. And then nutrition. It's not just about what you eat, it's when you eat it. You know, it's all about TRE, time-restricted eating. Again, people weren't meant to eat around the clock. I don't eat for 16 hours, generally 4 to 5 days a week overnight. let's just calm things down. It reduces my overall caloric intake, caloric restriction, eat less food, the ELF diet, if you haven't heard of ELF, eat less food diet. It's great for brain health. There's just no reason why we're eating so much food nowadays. Eat less, you'll be okay with it. It'll take some time, you'll be hungry, and then it'll go away. So these little idiosyncratic changes, the Mediterranean-style diet is critical. Blueberries and strawberries, half a cup several times a week. Caffeinated coffee earlier in the day, not late in the day, not afternoon, because that's going to mess up your sleep-wake cycles. Focusing on 7 to 8 minimum hours of sleep if you can. As we get older, it's harder to sleep, so 7, okay. But, 7.5, maybe a little better. Again, the list goes on and on. It has to be personalized for the individual person. But I think the thing that I didn't talk about yet, but could also spend several hours on, is vascular risk factor modification. And that's high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes. If people have diabetes, that will double your risk of Alzheimer's disease. Yes, that is a big number, and that is critical. It's not just about having normal numbers. It's about having optimal. The optimal blood pressure we usually shoot for is 120s over 70s or below. I think most doctors may not think about it like that. I think some people say, oh, you have prediabetes or borderline diabetes. Okay, just go exercise and eat more, eat less. Well, no. Let's attack this. Borderline diabetes is enough diabetes to fast forward brain decline. Let's get rid of that. Borderline cholesterol, what is that? What is borderline cholesterol? All the borderline people are actually high. And we're using old numbers like LDLs of 130. Like some people think that's okay. Well, no, that's not okay at all. LDL is the bad cholesterol. I mean, our group, we want less than 70. We don't even look at LDL anymore. That's outdated. We look at something called ApoB, A-P-O-B, E, capital A-P-O, lowercase, and then capital B. If you don't know what this is, it's okay. No one does. But talk to your doctor about it. Talk to your cardiologist. See a preventative cardiologist. The reference ranges that we use for normal labs are so off, and normal blood pressure are off when it comes to brain health. So again, for every little recommendation I can give, I can just keep going deeper and deeper, and I'll stop for now. But there's a lot we can do, and I think people need to know that.
Yeah, and I just think it's so helpful to have them here that you, like, I think one of the things that, the very, very few good things that came out of this pandemic is maybe making choices that, like, not being embarrassed about decisions, like working from home, or like what you're saying, just if you need to exercise while you're taking care of a meeting, do it, because there's a lot of value that comes from it. So when they hear that you do this as well, I think it'll give people a little more confidence to take those steps. And I want to ask you two quick things. One is about at the Schmidt College, do you think this is like the research that you want to be doing, is this like not very usual in medical schools around the country, and it's time to maybe consider focusing on Alzheimer's and increasing resources?
Yeah, well, we started the first, I started the first Alzheimer's prevention clinic in New York City back in 2013. And I can tell you, I saw my first Alzheimer's prevention patient back in 2009. And then I saw two more, and then I saw more and more. And then in 2011-12, I said, you know what? I need to see prevention patients. And my old boss at the time, an amazing guy, said, no, you can't prevent Alzheimer's. So I started interviewing around. I went to Harvard and Cornell and all over the Midwest. And Cornell was the only place that allowed me to start an Alzheimer's prevention clinic. Just a couple months ago, we published really among the first articles about preventive neurology as a subspecialty of neurology and a training program that we kind of said probably needs to happen. And I've trained some people, so there's a handful of people out there that have been trained. But no, I think preventative health is something that's really missed in our medical school training, in our society, in our medical, system. We treat disease, we get reimbursed. Doctors get money from the healthcare insurers, Medicare, Medicaid, for treating disease. Where is the funds to prevent disease? Where is the incentive for prevention? We are so misguided. And listen, I don't have the answers to fix our medical system in the United States or in the world. I wish I did. But the lack of reimbursement and the lack of attention on preventative health, it's such a missed opportunity. So when it comes to the field of preventative neurology, man, I wish, I hope, I pray that this becomes a recognized subspecialty of medicine. Cardiology, people are aware of, cardiologists treat disease but also prevent disease. And then there's a subset of cardiologists called preventive cardiologists. I was trained by Arthur Agatston, He's one of the fathers or founding fathers of the field in preventive cardiology. And when I was in Miami in 2001, and 20 years later, I'm trying to get the same stuff going for preventive neurology also. So, you know, I don't have the best answers on how to fast forward this, but man, I wish, you know, and I've trained fellows and medical students and other doctors. I've trained 45 to 50 other doctors from around the world, but then they go back to their home country or their home clinic, and then the reality sets in, like, how do I bill for this? Where's the reimbursement? Where's the buy-in? How do we make money from, like, how do we break even? The doctor's trying to break even. So, you know, I think what I would say is, from an educational perspective and a quality of care perspective, preventive neurology and preventative health is a huge missed opportunity. I hope our payers and I hope our medical system and I hope our, you know, institutions and I hope our, you know, guideline makers, both policy and medical, you know, start seeing the light and get their heads kind of out of the sand a little bit, because prevention is possible and prevention and the science is really real.
And one other thing I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you'd prefer to focus on Alzheimer's, but if you also could comment on, because I know of this, I've been wanting to do something about this clinic. I don't know what to call it really, but like a boxing clinic for people who have Parkinson's at a JCC here in North Miami. And and obviously you're not going to say that's a bad thing. So obviously you would say it's a good thing, I'm sure. But it just, like, I guess a comment on how not to think that when you have Parkinson's that you're just going to sit in a chair and you can't move. Maybe something about that as well, like the importance of movement.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we started the first Parkinson's prevention clinic in the country earlier this year, in mid-2021. Dr. Kellyanne Niotis is directing that in New York City. My brother, Stuart Isaacson, actually is a Parkinson's specialist, doing lots of clinical trials, actually. Also very interested in Parkinson's prevention. Exercise as a wellness center, actually, in Boca Raton. And we all work together. There's a small little group of us, but we're really, bullish that we can do something about Parkinson's. In terms of movement assessments, we're now doing very rigorous movement assessments. I've learned a lot about this. I went down the rabbit hole. In terms of Parkinson's prevention, there's a science to this. You know, doctors can now see a patient and before they have Parkinson's disease, and they may have sleep changes called REM sleep behavior disorder. They may have constipation, dandruff. They may have, other things that are 10, 20, 30 year symptoms before the Parkinson's symptoms of the tremor and the, you know, the rigidity, the stiffness and the problems with balance. So, you mentioned, you know, for example, rock steady boxing and different boxing classes. And, you know, there's lots of different types out there. Roberta Moronju, who's a neurogeneticist, an amazing woman at Cornell, who I've learned a lot from. This is how we need to treat people. And the treatment is prevention. And when it comes to Parkinson's disease, whether it's boxing, whether it's Tai Chi, whether it's caffeinated coffee, whether it's exercise on a regular basis, whether it's berries with anthocyanins, which are powerful antioxidants. You know, I'm not the expert in this area, Dr. Kellyanne and my brother and Roberta and other people. But I think we need, I wish I had, four hands and 48 hours in a day, I would be jumping on in the Parkinson's prevention and Lewy body prevention. I think Lewy body prevention, you know, I've seen probably a dozen or so patients to do the best I can within the realm of evidence for reducing risk or delaying the onset of Lewy body dementia, which is, you know, Robin Williams unfortunately had this and kind of, you know, spread awareness about this. But yeah, I think Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lewy body prevention, vascular dementia prevention, these are all things that are tangible that we can intervene on. There's not an exact science to this yet. It's confusing, and there's not a perfect algorithm, and each disease are going to need a different approach, different cholesterol numbers, different this, different that. But yeah, I think that this is the future. Preventive neurology is going to start with the main focus of preventative neurodegenerative and cognitive decline, and then hopefully we'll branch out to other conditions as well.
Is there anything I didn't ask you that you wanted to add?
I think if someone's listening and they feel overwhelmed, worried, oh my gosh, prevention, my dad had Parkinson's, my grandfather had Alzheimer's, just take a deep breath. I don't have, again, the magic pill just yet, but this is a new world, a new era, a new time. In the next 5 to 7 years, we're going to have better treatments, better options next 10 years. I mean, this is just, it's a different disease than it was when my Uncle Bob was diagnosed. It's a different disease today, and it'll be a different disease in 5, 7, and 10 years from now. So just take a deep breath, get educated, get informed, you know, grab the bull by the horns. We can do this. We can take control of our brain health. We want to promise not to overpromise. You know, I don't have the perfect answers by far, but my goodness, people do feel good and get better and have better health outcomes. And I've seen it over and over. And our research has proven this. You know, we've published 35, 40 papers in the last several years just on this one topic. So keep on keeping on and feel motivated that you can take control.
Yeah, that is so important. And one thing I did want to ask you, the media, reporters were covering so much that medication when you mentioned blockbuster medication, and then I never read about it again. And now I'm forgetting the name, which goes to show how little, but do you use it at all? And has there been anything good that came out of that?
Yeah, so, you know, the new medication is complicated. There was a new drug that was approved by the FDA for a mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's, which is the earliest symptomatic stage, as well as early mild Alzheimer's dementia, meaning the person has to have amyloid in their brain, in their spinal fluid or brain proven, as well as, you know, a clinical diagnosis. And I think what's happened with the drug is it's complicated because, first of all, it's not a pill. It's an infusion. It has to be given once a month, and that's complicated. And most doctors really weren't set up for that, like infusion beds, and this is a whole thing. The cost is also something that needs to be navigated, and insurance coverage when a new drug comes out. And then the other thing is, you have to get an MRI beforehand, and then you have to, monitor for potential side effects of the drug using serial MRIs, meaning continual MRIs over time. And also, then you have to slowly titrate, meaning slowly increase the dose of this medication, which is, again, given by an IV once a month in a clinic setting. When you have a new drug that has all these logistical operational hurdles, I think the field has had trouble, kind of operationalizing and getting it out there to people. The other part about this is the data were really complicated. The FDA decision was complicated. And, one of the trials looked one way, the other trials looked a little different. The FDA, approved it. Things were complicated and controversial. So I guess what I would say is, this is the first of, I think, a new class of drugs that I am hopeful that will be, available to help patients at some point in the future. I think there are obviously other FDA-approved drugs that are available now. Those are all pills for different stages of the disease. And I think, the decision on whether or not to use any drug or any treatment has to be made on a case-by-case basis with the treating physician and the person and the family based on cost, risk, time constraints, all these sorts of things, potential benefit, risk versus benefits. So this is a very long-winded answer because it's a complicated question. But again, I'm hopeful that these advances will continue to, reach a crescendo moment where we can better treat patients in a more optimal way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And that's all I wanted to ask you. I would love to speak with you for hours, but I'll guide listeners to the course because that's really an awesome resource. And just your time has been awesome. So thank you. And I wanted to ask you, This is not related to the interview. If you do you know of a colleague in neurology who treats people who have abnormally constant headaches?